This is The Hard Question on WCGO. Here's BQ.
What an interesting time to be able to talk to our very dear friend, Sargis Sangari, who is a retired U.S. Army colonel who saw extensive combat in the Middle East as a Special Operations Forces soldier. And he's been out there advising some of the fledgling Assyrian Christian Army in Iraq, known as I'm going to ask him how to pronounce this, Dweck Nwasha, with his military expertise, when it appears that we've got some issues there in Iran. From what I understand, there's going to be more American troops going in. You have Senator Chuck Schumer, who's basically saying this is the launch for President Trump's endless wars. But on the other hand, we've got guys like our good friend, Sargis Sangari, who can give us some insight because he's been there, he's done that, and he knows what's going on and what really happened. So, Sargis, welcome. Happy New Year. Thank you for joining us.
Happy New Year, Blanquita, and I hope you had a enjoyable Christmas, and what a way to start the New Year, I guess.
No kidding. Tell us about this General Qassem Soleimani.
Well, General Qassem Soleimani was very much of an integral part of the Iranian landscape when it came to what Iran was doing with its proxies throughout the entire region. We had looked at his profile June 4th in 2016 and laid out the case of who this individual is and what his perspective is going to be when it comes to Iranian future politics. And I would just ask your listeners to go and take a look at what we posted about him going back to 2016. He's dead, gone now. His replacement has already been tagged by the Ayatollah in Iran. The new individual is going to be Colonel Ismail Ghani, which is an individual who has served alongside with Soleimani in the past. But I think what it does is attack against him, removing him off the battlefield, actually does more help for us when it comes to our negotiations with Iran in the long term than it would have if he was still on the battlefield.
People don't really understand. You and I have talked about this in the past before, Sargis, about the real complicated way that Iran is kind of functioning with its own population. A great percentage of the population is really pretty young. At one point, the majority was under 30, and they really admired the United States. And there have been protests in Iran, but now it appears a lot of that's being squashed. And people are saying that this is going to be a time that this will empower the regime and that the retaliation is going to be strong. And a lot of people have been discussing the concern of sleeper cells in the United States. How do you read that?
Well, look, the sleeper cells in the United States is an issue that we could discuss all by itself. I mean, especially with the fact that Hezbollah is a major player in the tri-border region in South America. That's where their financing comes, their dollars come, how they move stuff. And if we don't secure our southern borders, these individuals constantly are moved in and out of the U.S. Remember, General Soleimani was going to conduct an assassination of the ambassador of Saudi Arabia to the United States in Washington, D.C. The only reason we were able to find out about it was when the previous POTUS struck a deal with Iran 6 days after he had paid them the money. It was the Iranian government leadership internally that wanted to continue negotiating with the United States in the long run that really sold out that possible assassination. So the first time General Soleimani was sold out was by the Iranians internally. In May of this past year also, if you take a look at it, Zarif himself, who's the foreign minister of Iran, put in his resignation because Soleimani was basically going everywhere possible, doing anything he wanted to without the Iranian State Department, in this case, their foreign ministry, knowing what the hell he's doing within the region. So Zarif stated, look, it's either going to be Soleimani or it's going to be me. Make a decision. And if you notice what has come out since his killing from the Ayatollah at the same time, Khamenei and also Zarif,
right.
there's been nothing stated in there that there's going to be a war, act of war against the U.S. or against Iran, but this action.
But right now, it's like a lot of show, and a lot of show potentially that could occur. You know, you and I've also talked about this, and I've mentioned it many times, that when I was in Venezuela, and I was in Venezuela approximately four times when I was a governor overseeing our Voice of America and Radio for Europe, etc. But in Venezuela, immediately, and in Bolivia, I noticed the presence of Iran, China, Cuba, and Russia. So where, first of all, to your point, I guess we're not paying attention to the presence of Iran there and how easily it would be for those forces to be able to go through our southern border and try to pass off as Latins, because I actually experienced that. And the other thing is, what is the relationship now then with countries like China and Russia with Iran and Iraq?
Look, China and Russia, when they created the Shanghai Cooperation Organization in the mid-90s, their whole goal was to be able to displace the United States to where China was going to be able to advance itself to what its 100-year plan was, to becoming the global dominant in the region. Now, we had written a article about power relations on the Near East site, going back to a decision that the previous administration made to kind of buy into that plan, which is a reason currently with the previous administration deciding to pull the forces out of the region. It made it so much more difficult for us to be able to negotiate even a bilateral agreement with Iran, given the fact that all these characters are there. Don't be surprised if Russia was egging Iran on and China for them to take some of the actions they did against the U.S. Footprint within the region. Right now, there's a vote that's being held in the Iraqi government, and that vote is going to be whether or not to make a decision if they're going to keep the U.S. forces in the region or ask us to leave. Hezbollah, that is operating within the Iraqi borders, to include the Hashish Shabi, which is the these force structures that were created to clear Mosul after the Iraqi army collapsed. So in such a bad way, have stated that if any MP votes against this vote, we're going to expose their name and their address, and we're going to allow the people to take revenge against them. So Iraq may implode internally. If you're an MP in Iraq, are you going to vote against or for the U.S. to remain there? These are the issues that we have to consider as we are stating that the POTUS did not make the right call by taking out Soleimani. Soleimani's debt will open up the doors for a much faster negotiation with Iran to get to a new contract. It may not be the contract we're looking for, but it's going to be a contract that's going to allow us to look at a better, maybe a long-term deal, maybe even a treaty with Iran in the future.
What was the urgency of taking him out the way that we did? And apparently it was, you know, all they could find of his remains was a ring. Does he now become a martyr?
Nobody cares. Whatever he becomes, he's dead. That's all that matters.
No, but not for us. We don't care. But there, you know, people, it's like a PR move. You know, it's like putting up a poster and saying...
But you got to listen. Yeah, you got to listen to what Khamenei and Zarif said. Both of them came out, and none of them said that there's going to be any attacks by the U.S., by the Iranian governmental structure against the United States. Khamenei himself said that, you know, this can be left up to the people, and it's the people that are going to seek revenge against what happened. Same thing Zarif. Zarif said it's going to make the root of the resistance stronger. None of them came out that said the Iranian government sees this as a direct attack against Iran and that they are going to utilize every apparatus in the Iranian arsenal to take vengeance against the United States. Another critical factor is, which is very important, is for the first time Khamenei in the entire history of the National Security Committee meeting for special sessions, that this might be the first time he's actually attending it. That's how important the strike was. It is a game changer. It resets everything, not so much for the U.S., but it resets everything for the Iranian government to be able to clear up his mess, to be able to finally negotiate with us on the terms that we were looking to negotiate with them.
We have a very special guest on this hour of The Hard Question here on WCGO in Chicago. And don't forget, you can catch us on the SoundCloud and TuneIn and a variety of sources, especially Smart Talk Radio Network, which is us. And thank you to our sponsor, John Lester Insurance, lesterinsure1.com. I'm Blanquita Cullum.
This is The Hard Question on WCGO. Here's BQ.
Of course, a lot of people become a bit concerned by what happened in the Middle East. If religious peoples are always worried about whether it's going to be leading to the apocalypse. Other people concerned that it'll be a third world war. A lot of people on the Democratic side of the aisle have labeled this President Trump's Benghazi. But a man who really understands what goes on in the Middle East is our guest, a retired U.S. Army colonel who saw extensive combat in the Middle East as a Special Operations Forces soldier. Our guest, Lieutenant Colonel Sargis Sangari, who incidentally, we're going to talk about this in the next segment, Sargis, you're running really for Congress again in a district that's very close to us, the 9th Congressional District. But Sargis, what do you think about the term when they talk about this being the president's Benghazi?
Look, this is one of the reasons I'm running, Blanquita. It's just, you know, you got to send adults to Washington. I'm tired of having individuals stand up there, dictate to me what I should be doing, or the children who just either, you know, listen to you or don't listen to you. Send adults and let the adults kind of sit down and go through the process. This is a fog of battle. These things happen. You cannot be sucked into sound bites. You get a concentration on what the, you know, U.S. foreign policy in the long term has to be. Yes, we are going to see some activity against possible U.S. interests in the region. In Kashmir, you have protesters out. In Lahore itself, Pakistan, the entire U.S. embassy has been secured by the Pakistan forces to include their military force structures of a possible attack currently. As I'm speaking to you, American contractors and Europeans that are tied to oil companies in Iraq and most of the embassy staff is being evacuated right from the region. These are the things that happen. But in that process, in the long term, if it gets us to a better deal with Iran, so be it.
You know, I was looking at your bio, and I want to share some of it, Sargis, because it's very important for people to understand, especially to your point when you get to Congress. A lot of people don't understand the Middle East. It's much more complicated, and it's very tribal, and you have the borders that go on, you know, close to Israel, and there's all kinds of things happening. But you had 6 years of continuous combat deployment. You conducted 144 combat patrols, 22 special forces missions, 2 direct action operations while surviving, 7 improvised explosive attacks, 1 enemy checkpoint engagement with no loss of life while being awarded the Combat Action Badge for the operations. You conducted 670 key leader and tribal leader engagements in support of multiple counterinsurgency operations to counter and malign enemy influences and terrorist activities in the region. I think it's important for people to know. And you grew up in Iran until you were 10, and you are fluent in Arabic, Aramaic, and Assyrian, which I can't tell you. I think it's very limited how many members of Congress have that capability, except for people like Congresswoman Ilhan Omar, who is lambasting the president for this action.
Well, look, it's not the talent you have, it's what you do with that talent. And part of the reason I decided to get involved in running here in the 9th Congressional District is the fact that I saw that everything that we were fighting about, everything that we're doing downrange, was basically we were giving golden nuggets to the State Department, National Security Council, and individuals in Congress, and they were basically turning it into poop. And I got tired of it. And I said, you got to be at the table if you're going to have a say on how things need to move forward. Jan Schatzky, who I'm running against in the 9th Congressional District on the Democratic side, on the day that the president is getting impeached, she's standing on the House floor promoting her son as being the reason why she decided to vote for impeachment for the president, because he's the one who reminded her of her responsibilities. Look, I learned responsibilities in the U.S. military, fighting in combat areas of operation, like you mentioned, and also battlefield. My parents taught me that. I don't need to have a kid to teach me my responsibilities to remind me of them. At the same time, I don't need to be promoting that individual to be the next person to replace me on the House floor when you're looking at impeaching the president, who's mm-hmm. right now struggling to try to ensure North Korea doesn't develop its missile capabilities more than they have currently to be able to strike us, and bring Iran to the negotiation table so we don't have a nuclear war or a larger fight within the region. I mean, these are the things that need to be resolved and cannot do it with the current actors we have in Congress.
Do you remember, with those areas of nuclear concern, we never were able to go in and check what was going on, the capability, how much potential they had. And of course, that makes me wonder again, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. What is the relationship with North Korea, and other areas of the world that could compromise the national security of the United States?
Well, I just came back from South Korea. I went there for a specific reason in order to add to the assessment which we had done and we had provided to the National Security Council on what was happening with China being behind the Burmese genocide in Southeast Asia. When I came back, it was very obvious to me that as much as we're putting pressure on North Korea, the one character that is affecting our national security policy negatively is actually the leader of South Korea, in this case Moon, who has established a liaison office on the border of on the DMZ, and has bypassed our sanctions in support of North Korean aims more than South Korea. Japan was sending, large amounts of industrial chemicals to South Korea. South Korea was allowing at least some of those chemicals to include 200 cases of unaccompanied authorized requirements to North Korea.
Let me stop you there, because when I was in South Korea, one of the things that concerned me was meeting with some of those very important leaders in South Korea who are very sympathetic. They were very sympathetic to North Korea, and some of those leaders, and of course this would be now about 10 years ago, were ready to make deals to work with North Korea. And in a way, a lot of people were suggesting they wanted to be able to make the countries closer, bigger, and more open with each other. Is that still in effect, or is that changed?
No, the current leadership is surrendering South Korea to North Korea, basically, and putting it under Chinese dominance in the long run. And the reason I mention this is because, again, we go back to the members of Congress who have a shallow understanding of foreign policy. In May, you had Jan Schakowsky from the 9th Congressional District going with a Republican delegation to South Korea, and is now tied to a promotion of this concept of this, reunification. But the reunification, doing it this way, is not a positive. It has consequences for us. And this is what happens when you have individuals that sit in these congressional seats for 20-plus years who have no understanding, deep understanding of these foreign policy issues and how they affect our people, to include the Korean community here in the 9th Congressional District. You got to get people to understand foreign policy and to understand how it ties to domestic issues to be able to operate in Congress in support of our wants and desires for a much better, long-term, stronger America.
The thing of it is, to your point on that, Sargis, is, it's a complicated chessboard, but unfortunately, we don't know all of these countries and these leaders. We say, the Middle East, and we blow it off. But the Middle East has its own issues. Looking at Saudi Arabia, looking at other countries, like, as we talked about, Jordan. Do they still maintain their kind of Switzerland-like status? Turkey? What about Turkey? What about Israel? We're going to come back. We have more to talk about with Sargis Sangari, who's running for the Congressional District, the 9th Congressional District in Illinois, right in our area, as a matter of fact. I'm Blanquita Cullum. This is The Hard Question on WCGO. And don't forget, you can get us on WCGOradio.com.
This is The Hard Question on WCGO.
And our guest is retired Lieutenant Colonel Sargis Sangari, who is running for the 9th Congressional District right in our area. And Sargis, one of the things I was thinking about when you were talking about Iraq, remember there was that period of time in the 2000s, early 2000s and 1990s. They didn't want us to leave at all. In fact, we wanted to leave, and there was a big stink about it. Now it seems they can't wait for us to get out.
I think that's because Iran did his job as far as trying to take over Iraq as best as possible. And within the governmental structure of the Iraqi government, they're in place. As I said, there's a vote being held currently by the Iraqi parliament to see whether or not we should leave Iraq or our military forces. And Hezbollah, that is operating in Iran, to include Hashish Shaabi, whose second in command was basically killed during the strike, have stated that if any MP in the Iraqi parliament votes against the resolution for the U.S. to pull out, we're going to expose our names and their addresses, and we'll let the people take vengeance on them. So if you're an MP right now sitting in Iraq, are the chances you're going to vote against it? That's a question that has to be asked. Look, State Department, for the longest time on the U.S. side, made major mistakes, a lot of mistakes. When we were operating the force Dwaknosha on the ground, the Syrian army force structure, they came in and they said, here's what we want the Christians to do in Iraq. You're going to either have to be under the Iraqi Hashish Shaabi, basically, who the second in command we killed just with the strike, or you're going to have to go be under the Peshmerga. So what they did, they forced the Christian Assyrians to have to go either be under the Peshmerga, and there's a force, Nineveh Protection Unit, that is still stuck under the chain of command of Hashish Shaabi. So what do you expect these poor Christians to do when you pull the U.S. forces out of there? These are the type of decisions that people at a State Department force against the will of the individuals who were advising him as to what the right process should be that has led us to this. Unfortunately, State Department doesn't hang out one of their own to dry, and the congressmen and congresswomen who agree to these decisions, because they're the ones who approve functional budget $150, just like us Jan Schakowsky, will never take responsibility for the stupid decisions that they make. But, no decision is right or wrong. It has consequences.
Well, absolutely. And I want to move you to some of these other countries that I think are important. Israel and Jordan, Palestine, Turkey, some of these countries, Egypt, Syria, how do they play into all of this? What happens with all of them?
Well, look, they all have internal dynamics themselves, and those internal dynamics cannot be overstated. Israel itself has had a number of strategic requirements that has to meet when it comes to what it's dealing with. They're going to have an emergency session that they're holding currently to figure out what they want to do with their operations that need to be moved forward now based on the death of Soleimani. And all these things are kind of tied in together. These are what
and you have Netanyahu's
decision point.
I'm sorry to interrupt you. Netanyahu's also in a kind of a pickle there too.
Well, Netanyahu is in a pickle. But with that, there's also possible opportunities depending on what ends up happening. Because if you look at it, Naftali Bennett, who is currently in the security structure of the Israeli government, will probably have more of a say on operations, because with what Netanyahu is facing, he's going to have to turn over a lot of what would be under the prime minister's control to him. Mm-hmm. And I think he's a pretty capable guy when it comes to security of Israel, and you can see some major operations against Hezbollah that hadn't existed before, even under Netanyahu. And it's possible that Naftali Bennett, because of that, might emerge as a possible future prime minister for Israel.
And he will be a good ally for us in the long run. Since we're short on time, you know, I would love to just continue, but we have just a little bit of time left. All right, so in that delicate region, you've got Syria, you've got Lebanon, you've got Jordan, you've got Egypt, and those, you know, very close to Jerusalem and Israel, rather. I mean, it's a tiny little country. So how does that play into it? Where is Syria? What goes on with Egypt? What happens with all this stuff?
I think the killing of General Qassam is going to actually give us a much better closure to how we may approach negotiations with Iran. And I think you can see a much easier, much more focused negotiation when it comes to Syria, and also to what is going to happen in the larger region going forward. But we could be into a possible 5 more years of regional wars and proxy wars within the region in this new decade, unfortunately.
And what's going to happen with Turkey?
Turkey will continue to get squeezed. Turkey, we have taken most of their options away from them. They have a choice to make. Either they're going to have to go deeper, and believe it or not, even in northern Iraq, where they're already conducting air operations south of the Sinjar line in Iraq, or they have to expand their footprint. My worry is that the Kurds are going to be used again to destabilize the region, because as soon as the decisions were made to squeeze Turkey, the first thing that happened was the Kurdish leadership in northern Iraq met with UAE and Saudi. It is possible that almost 3 large aircrafts landed in northern Iraq with weapon systems. Those weapon systems will end up either one being used to fight against the Iraqi government when it comes over to Kirkuk, or is going to be moved either to northwest Iran, where the Kurds will use it in an internal fight against Iran, or will be moved into Syria. And unfortunately, if the Kurds decide to do that for their own financial benefit, in the long run, is going to cause more of a havoc to our foreign policy. So I'm hoping that the Sunni Muslim Kurds understand that what they tried to do in the past to secure dollars for their own tribal groups is not what's going to be going forward in the future, especially under the current administration. You have to come to the table with resolutions of how you are going to finally be part of the fabric of the region and not a separate fabric to the region.
And just about 20 seconds on this one, Sargis. Saudi Arabia, they don't really know how to defend themselves. They've got so many complicated issues there in Saudi Arabia. What is going to happen with them?
Now, Saudi Arabia is just going to continue writing checks. That's all they can do. And I've said that before on your show. Saudi Arabia, the only concern is for the leadership to continue staying in power. They don't care about their people. They could care less if Iran attacks even their oil fields. They're just more content of ensuring that the royal family continues to be in a position of dominance in Saudi.
I tell you, these are fascinating times. And then the last one is about, where does Jordan play into this? Does it stay in the center? Does it stay like Switzerland? Can it play that game, or are they getting pressure?
Jordan has to deal with his internal politics when it comes to the Palestinians. And if it doesn't, even Jordan has an opportunity of imploding internally. Just because they're a stable ally does not mean that their past is not a harbinger of their future. And it depends on what the Palestinians decide to do within the borders of Jordan, which you can tell us if we're leading to a larger fight in that region, or there's going to be a possible settlement along what is going to happen with a one-state solution, not a two-state solution when it comes to Israel.
Boy, I'll tell you, these are fragile times and interesting times. So what's next for you? Are you going to be out there in the district trying to talk to folks? Are you going to be making any personal appearances?
That's it. I just got to get them to know, and I have to flip the independents and Democrats to vote for me this time. And let's hope we can send somebody to D.C. who could help us.
Well, we'll be in touch with you again, my friend. Thank you for joining us. Retired Lieutenant Colonel Sargis Sangari, who is really someone who knows what's going on in the Middle East. It's about better than anybody I know. I'm Blanquita Cullum. Thank you for joining us. Have a wonderful Friday in this new year. And join us on Monday, as always, here on WCGO.